Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to Sunday Roast. It's Sunday the 15th of June. I'm Phil Carroll.
And I'm Kevin Hornsby.
It's Father's Day. Here's to all the fathers out there. Big up the dads.
Yeah.
You deserve it. I mean, I'm down in Le Mans at the moment. It always seems to coincide with Father's Day. So a little treat to myself, but amazing place, cool people. I do love this place. And but how is Jordan, Kev?
Well, we've had air raid sirens most of the night, and into ballistic missiles and drones going over our head. So, yeah, it's entertaining, let's put it that way.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. Yeah.
It's the real world, guys. It's real, you know. It's like war playing out above your head, I suppose. I think the Israelis had sent drones further out. We're about 20, 30 miles in Amman from the border, maybe not even. About to get on a bus now to go to Aqaba so that we can go over the Red Sea back to Egypt because the airspaces are closed. Looks like the airspaces have been told to close, and also the Russian authorities have said that they will not send any planes this way for 2 weeks. So that's basically what we're in for, I think. We're in for a two-week minimum war, I think, as the Israelis have said. They're at war with Iran now. So, scary situations.
It's been coming, though, hasn't it? I mean, it's, as you said there, so that the news really dominated by the headlines. Tensions escalated sharply after Israel launched Operation Rising Lion, conducting large-scale airstrikes on Iranian soil, targeting at least 100 nuclear and military facilities, and reportedly killing top IRGC commanders like Hossein Salami and Mohammed Bagheri, as well as key nuclear scientists. In retaliation, Iran responded with Operation True Promise 3, launching over 150 ballistic missiles and 100-plus drones at Israel. Whilst most were intercepted, Tel Aviv experienced siren disruptions and minor injuries. I think that from what I can see online overnight on the wires, there was about 32 injuries. Obviously, as you said, you know, an intercontinental ballistic missile landed in Tel Aviv, one of the residential areas there. Caused significant damage to buildings, etc. So, for sure, they can't intercept all of them. Obviously, with the help of the US online, they've brought down quite a lot of them. But, I mean, I think I said to you when I heard the news that this is, you know, Iran has been moving ever closer to enriched uranium, you know, weapons-grade uranium to build atomic bombs, you know, to go nuclear. So this is kind of like nipping that in the bud, the fact that they've targeted 100 plus nuclear facilities and obviously killed a lot of their nuclear scientists, probably putting them back another however many years. But this is obviously not just a sole reason, but certainly one of the reasons, isn't it, why they've targeted them now.
I mean, I think people need to understand that effectively Lebanon and Hezbollah has been a proxy for Iran for many decades. So, you know, I don't think the West really probably understands that. That's one of the reasons why Israel moved in and cleared out most of Hezbollah in Lebanon a month or two back. Because effectively the Iranian authorities, if you like, have been paying for and making sure that Hezbollah in Lebanon was armed so that it could affect Israel. So Israel cleared Hezbollah out of the way a couple of months ago by going into Lebanon, and that cleared the way now to attack Iran without having a close enemy, if you like, in terms of Hezbollah.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, I mean, as you said there, I think there's the US also have a strong interest in curbing Iran's influence in the region. As you say, not just the nuclear, but, you know, limiting Iran's support for groups like Hezbollah and other kind of proxy groups. And I mean, it's sad to see, but kind of, I hate to say it, but, you know, inevitable. It was coming, really.
Yeah, you're probably right, especially with someone like Netanyahu in charge, who, you know, is basically looking at the whole situation and using protectionism to say, I'm going after him, or going after them. So yeah, I mean, it's effectively, I don't like to say it's Israel, it's the Zionist state of Israel who is, and I repeat it again, I said it on some of the social media groups last night. There's a podcast called Martyr Made, The New Jerusalem. It's been out for maybe 5, 6, 7 years. It's very long, listens 26 hours or something. But if you want to really understand Zionism and where it all came from in sort of the 1800s and through that period, then you might understand a bit more about modern day Israel and what it's all about.
Then we saw the news, tragic crash of Air India Flight AI-171, which was obviously a Boeing 787 Dreamliner, which I believe was the first time that the Dreamliner, it's an impeccable safety record, but the first fatality, effectively crash involving the Dreamliner, resulted in the loss of 241 out of 242 people on board. The sole survivor, a British national, sustained only minor injuries and is currently recovering. The investigators have successfully recovered the flight data recorder, which will play a crucial role in determining the cause of the crash. And it obviously occurred shortly after takeoff from Ahmedabad, caused casualties on the ground. So, yeah, obviously terrible to see that one. And obviously, there's some footage, shocking footage of it literally from the runway as it sort of took off. It dropped pretty quickly after shortly after takeoff, around 4 miles in, and obviously hit a what looked like a medical college where students were dining in the canteen at the time of the incident. So, I mean, can you imagine surviving something like that, but being that sole survivor who had literally minor injuries? I think he was in seat 11A from what I can see online, right by the emergency exit there. Obviously, he effectively said he witnessed it, woke up and thought, what's gone on?
Holy crap. I mean, I saw a video of him on social media just walking down the road, if you like, afterwards. Like the well, it's a miracle, isn't it? I mean, thoughts go out to the 241 people who perished, because it's obviously an absolutely tragic accident. I don't know how many people died on the ground as well. I really don't know.
Currently unannounced. I think they're still sort of sifting route through wreckage, but you can guarantee it'll be into the teens to the 20s.
Yeah, it's extremely sad, isn't it? But we move on. Life has to carry on, doesn't it? And we've still had craziness, and as you say, you're in Le Mans, I'm in the middle of a war. It's all very interesting.
And then obviously Trump's remained pretty quiet on the whole kind of Israel thing. We haven't heard a statement from him yet. But interestingly, last week when we went to air, we talked a little bit about the bromance being over, but certainly the spat that ensued. We didn't really talk about it because we recorded it on the Thursday. But what did you make of the whole sort of fallout between Elon and Trump? And it initially started where Elon made a basically criticism of the big, beautiful bill, calling it a disgusting abomination. And then we saw later that the fallout whereby Donald Trump basically said he was going to cut spending towards some of his, effectively Trump's sorry, Musk's business plans. And then it was then really then it kicked off where Musk tweeted that the real Donald Trump is in the Epstein files, hinting that Trump's alleged name might be why those records remain sealed. Obviously, Trump then dismissed the claim, threatened consequences like pulling federal contacts, and then Musk said Musk had lost his mind. Musk has since later deleted the Epstein post, but the damage has effectively been done, and their spat coincided with Dogecoin tumbling as investors reacted to the acrimony. Obviously, we also saw Tesla shares plummet as well on open. But he actually then since posted on X, I regret some of the posts I made last week about Trump, and they went too far. So I think he's seen the error of his ways. We did say, didn't we? You and I were having conversations saying this is just getting ridiculous now. I mean, like, it is. This is probably one of the most costly tweets of all time.
Yeah, well, there was no way Trump was going to back down, is there? So it's pretty inevitable that he backed down, and then we've seen the Tesla stock do very well the rest of this week, haven't we? After he did this, and genuinely, there's a lot of news around Tesla and the self-drive taxis and the robotics, and I think actually Tesla could be one hell of an investment going forward, to be honest, which I haven't said before, but it's looking like it could be change the world type of stock. But yeah, it's absolute madness, absolute madness. I mean, just huge egos clashing, and that's what happens, you know.
Yeah,
So
two man babies throwing the toys out of the pram,
yeah,
effectively.
and that's exactly what it was. But because of social media and because of the immediacy of these things and how the world can view it now, then it becomes a big deal. Who says a spat like that didn't happen, 20 years ago between a big businessman and the president? Probably did, but we didn't live it in real time then, did we? So it was crazy, 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 crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. Well,
And then you've got, still Trump saying the 51st state and all these other different things that he's talking about. But our next guest actually is those guys are based in Canada. So do you want to introduce them, Phil?
it's been a while since we've had First Class Metals appear on the roast, but we welcome back James Knowles, Executive Chair, and Mark Sale, CEO. Welcome back to the podcast, gents. How's life treating you both?
I felt really good, thank you. It's been a tricky few months, but we feel we're making good progress at the moment. So it's good to get back on and give you an update.
Thanks, Phil. It's been a busy winter for us, as you would have appreciated from the press release we put out the other day. So, although we've been quiet in a media sense, we certainly haven't been quiet in a work sense. I've been to Canada 3 times already this year. So, yeah, we're pushing back the frontiers as far as the exploration is concerned and the general work requirements and commitments.
Absolutely, yeah. As you say, you've both been vi busy behind the scenes, so we've got plenty to unpack. In late September, First Class Metals initially secured strategic funding from the 79th Group in a two-stage deal. In May, there was a corporate update revealing a substantial LOI and fundraising following withdrawal of stage two investment from 79th. And just this week, you released a winter exploration program update detailing robust progress on North Hemlo and Royzone structural work, as well as new lithium and REE targets from Quinlan samples. So let's just start from the beginning there. Obviously, the 79th Group investment fallout. Just walk us through what happened with the 79th Group stage investment withdrawal. Was it unexpected, and how has this reshaped your near-term strategy?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say it was completely unexpected, Phil. It was a left field hit us from a direction we didn't expect, and we've been recovering since that stage. We took the 79th Group through a very detailed due diligence process, which at the time was sufficient for what we needed. It was for the prospectus we had was passed by the FCA. Everything was going through nicely. Stage one completed at the end of February, and unfortunately, 3 days later, allegations were made against the 79th Group by the City of London Police, and an investigation started at that point, which ultimately, as you're well aware, brought the process to a halt and the demise of it as the 79th Group went into administration. So, not a particularly good time for us, unexpected, but we're getting through it though. I think we've steadied the ship. We're making good progress, and it's getting further in the rearview mirror, hopefully.
And I think, Phil, the fact that we had that winter press release that you just alluded to, that was the basis for which we went out and very quickly raised £520,000 last week. And I think that's testament to the quality, the caliber of the projects we've got, the work we're doing, and the anticipation of what this money can provide going down the line as far as the news flow is concerned.
Absolutely, yeah. And obviously following that LOI that we saw as well, and as you just said, that the recent fundraise, how confident are you in bridging the funding gap and then keeping that momentum going across those, that your core projects?
I am confident that the money we've raised, and in fact, we've initiated the summer, shall we say, field work program today. I've written to Emerald, who are doing the work for us on work at Sunbeam, as alluded to in the press release. And that started, in some ways, you could actually say that we started the summer program last month because we completed the VLF over the Dead Otter Trend at North Hemlo, which had originally been part of the winter program, but because there was such a lot of snow in there, we deferred it. So we've already done a significant amount of work this summer season on Dead Otter. And that will, I feel, really enhance our ability to target in on the juicy areas. And as I say, we'll be starting in the next couple of days work on the Sunbeam property, initially around the Roy zone, where I had what I felt was a bit of a eureka moment when I was out there with the structural geologists. So it is, yes, you're right. In the press release, we mentioned more than just Sunbeam and North Hemlo, but those are the ones we're pushing at the moment. And I'd like to think they're the ones that are going to provide us with good news flow going forward, which, of course, news flow, positive news flow begets share price increase, investor increase. I know I'm always getting told off for saying it, but the more successful we are in the exploration, the more money I want to spend.
Yeah, absolutely. And just talk us through, as I mentioned at the top there, we talked about these rare earth targets, I think, from Quinlan. Elaborate a little bit on those findings and what, exploration may look like going forward at those targets.
We will be doing some work on Quinlan. It's not going to be a priority. As I said in the press release, the lake sediment results that we received from Quinlan weren't of the caliber that the OGS produced in their survey. However, in the northwest area where there is significant amount of pegmatite outcrop, which reported from the helicopter flyover, is where we got our best lithium lake sediment results with, of course, other, as I say, critical and rare earth element results. So that area is worth carrying on with and looking at. And we'll take it from there. As you know, it's under option. We've just about completed our first year's work commitment, so we're relaxed about that.
Great. Mark, James, glad to see you back. I know I've been in contact with you throughout this period of time a few times. Yeah, you've done well to get to this point, I think, considering the situation that was thrust upon you. But that said, I want people to understand, Mark, a little bit about what assets you're going after. For anybody who doesn't know the story in First Class Metals, what assets have you got? What assets are you going after? Whether it be lithium, gold, et cetera, et cetera. Can you just give us an overview of how you would look at First Class Metals today?
For sure, Kevin. It's very simple. Our focus is gold, gold, and more gold. And that's why we've sort of changed from North Hemlo being the flagship property to North Hemlo and the Sunbeam properties being the flagship properties, plural. I really like North Hemlo. The Dead Otter trend is a new gold discovery in the North Limb. The VLF work we did over the winter has proved some very strong conductors at Rogers Lake, north and south, and especially on the OnGold property, which is now ours. We had it under option, but now 100% ours. That had the highest lake sediment sample that we're aware of in the North Limb of the Hemlo Belt. We did VLF around the lake and on the lake because we could in the winter when it was frozen. And again, the preliminary results indicate some very strong conductors there. So we did five grids of VLF. Every one has come up with some really strong conductors. So we've got a lot to focus on in the North Hemlo area. Having said that, some of them are peripheral to Panther's Dotted Lake. So it might well be that these targets produce gold and other things like base metals. But primarily, we will be focusing on the Dead Otter trend and following up with the VLF on North Hemlo. Sunbeam, I mean, when you think about it, Phil, we and Kevin, North Hemlo Dead Otter is just under 4 kilometers long. New discovery, 19.6 grams gold. Very nice. Thank you very much. Then we go over to Sunbeam. We've got three and some minor, three robust trends there, sub-parallel, each one over 10 kilometers long. Each one's got a historical development on it, Sunbeam, Roy, and Pettigrew. So really, it's a no-brainer that we've got 3 times 10 kilometers on Sunbeam and 1 times 3 and a bit, nearly 4 kilometers on North Hemlo. So where's the money going to go to start with? It's going to go on Sunbeam because it's got a past producing high-grade gold mine. It's got three robust gold-bearing shears. It's 10 kilometers from Hammond Reef, which is a 3.8 million, I think, ounce deposit of similar geology. So yes, Sunbeam's the focus at the moment, without doubt. But overall, gold is the focus. Yes, we have the Zigzag lithium property, which is very nice. Thank you very much. But we all know lithium, it will come back, but it's It's a slow recovery for it at the moment. But we had a very good drilling program on Zigzag, good hits in the holes. Everyone was interested in it. We might do a little bit of metallurgical work on that beneficiation in order to see how we can upgrade the lithium content of the potential ore. Quinlan, as you mentioned, Phil, it's worth following up on the lithium and the rare earths and the critical metals there. And then, of course, we've got other properties like Essa that needs more work on, only 10 kilometers from Hemlo Mine. And again, that's gold, Kevin. And
So,
as
Mark,
I mentioned.
let me stop you there, right? Okay.
Yeah.
So, if it's all about gold, the last time we talked to you, gold was not $3,300 an ounce, I should say. So, obviously, that's made these projects more financially viable, if you like. But the other thing is, why is this area, particularly in Ontario, why is this area about gold? Give people a bit of a history lesson.
The focus in that area in the Hemlo camp is obviously because of the Hemlo gold mine, which goes back, what, 40 years. One of the reasons I like that area, the Hemlo area, we'll talk about Sunbeam separately, the Hemlo area, is because you've got the Barrick gold mine there, which is 23 odd million ounces past and current and future reserves. But I don't know of another greenstone belt in the world, whether we're talking Canada, Western Australia, Russia, Africa, where you've got a 10 plus million ounce gold discovery without satellite 1 million ounce plus discoveries. And you just don't have that in the Hemlo belt. You've got the Hemlo mine, you've got the Sugar Zone mine further to the east towards Wawa, and that's it. I mean, you go up to Red Lake, you go up to Kirkland Lake, and these things travel in groups. You don't just get one multi-million ounce mine. And I know Barrick was very interested in that concept as well. And they did a lot of work a couple of summers ago doing regional sampling to try and understand the geochemistry. So that's, for me, that's one of the big attractions of the Hemlo area and the North Limb, which has not had as much work on it as the South Limb, where the Hemlo gold mine is that there is real potential. And I know, okay, maybe I was talking down North Hemlo over Sunbeam, but the fact remains there is a 23 million ounce deposit only 23 kilometers away from where we are. So the elephant country potential is there. The mathematics, the average game, shall we say, over in Sunbeam is greater because you've got 10 times the length of structure. But in the Hemlo area, there's proven case for multi-million ounce discoveries.
I was going to say, I mean, as an offshoot of what the Hemlo mine has produced, to find another scenario with a million plus ounces is not beyond the bounds of possibility. In fact, it's probably quite likely, as you've already found gold on these licenses.
Yeah, as I say, statistically, if you look at the gold endowment of greenstone belts around the world, if you've got a plus 10 million ounce deposit, you'll have several million ounce deposits as well.
And you're not greedy, Mark. You only want one. Or do you want two?
No, I'd like five, because then people like Barrick will come and knock on our door even harder.
Okay, very good. So, James, give us your view of what's been going on, and also, where do you go from here in terms of this letter of intent, and and I hate to use timescales, but when are we talking? This going to be during the summer that this can all be sorted out?
Yeah, well, you'd hope so, and I think we've definitely steadied the ship with what we've done this last few weeks, and we've put ourselves in a strong position. And whilst we don't want to overly dwell on this letter of intent, the aim would be to bring it to a swifter conclusion as what we can during this summer period. So yeah, that will be the target. But obviously, there's a lot of legal things to go on, due diligence and so forth before we get to that stage, and we'll update accordingly when we can in the near future.
And if you're interested basically in gold, or gold in a safe jurisdiction such as Canada and on a green belt, then you guys are pretty well positioned.
Yeah, definitely. I
Very
think
much so.
with the assets we've managed to accumulate over this last couple of years, adding to ones what we IPO'd with, are quite impressive for a company of our size. We've got almost an embarrassment of options which we're working through and targeting the most potential productive of them. So yeah, I think we're in a really strong position at the moment. The price of gold's working in our favour, the jurisdiction and the work we've done in the past has just enforced that even more so. So yeah, I'm quite happy.
I think another important aspect too is that, well, two things really, is one, all our claims are in good standing for this year. So we are in a fortunate position, unlike when we IPO'd and we had to do work on everything in order to keep them in good standing. We can focus now. We can say, okay, we won't do any work on Zigzag because we don't have to. We won't do any work on KERS because it's up to date as far as the assessment reports are concerned. The same with ESSA. So we can choose. We can choose to focus on North Hemlo. We can choose to focus on Sunbury. And I think the other important aspect, and I know in some ways it's the elephant in the room, but we have, I feel, exceptionally good relationships with the three First Nations. One over North Hemlo and the two at Sunbeam. As I say, I have regular catch-ups with them. In fact, when I was out there earlier in the year, Netmazagami, the North Hemlo First Nations people, they were barricading a road to stop another First Nation coming in and netting one of their lakes. And I wanted to talk with the council and the land administrator. And they said, look, we're busy. I said, well, can I come out there and see you and talk to you whilst I'm out there? And you would not believe how sort of happy and pleased they were that I'd made the effort to go out into the blizzard and the driving snow and the cold in order to sit with them for a couple of hours and just chat about things. So First Nations relationships are becoming more and more a hot topic in Ontario. And fortunately, I believe that we have very good relationships with prime First Nations people.
I would say, Mark, that you talk the hind leg off a stool, no? When you get ridden.
Off a donkey.
No, I think fair play to Mark. I mean, I think that day you mentioned that there was possibly a 10-hour drive involved, 5 hours
Wow.
each way, in not particularly pleasant winter conditions to go and see those guys. There's probably not many CEOs of listed companies have put that effort in that
No,
environment.
reputation and relationships are obviously how business is done. If there's business to be done in the future, I'm sure it's going to be positive. Now, Mark, I have one last question for you, really, and that's just about Canada in general. Obviously, it's becoming the 51st state, as we well know, as Mr. Trump has said. So, how is that impacting what's going on in Canada?
The sentiment of the Canadians is quite anti-American these days, but they need each other to survive in a business sense. But certainly in Thunder Bay, which is only, I think, 50 miles from the American border, the people are saying the number of border crossings from Canada into America is a lot less, even though Americans coming into Canada is more or less the same. I mean, I was staying at a fishing lodge. It was closed for fishing, obviously, because the lake was still frozen. But they were saying that their bookings from American fishermen hadn't declined. So I think you have the political level of unrest, then you have the average man in the street level of, oh, bloody Trump, bloody American, excuse my language, but business must go on.
Yeah, but from a point of view of you've obviously changed the Prime Minister now as well. Is that going to be mining positive or probably pretty neutral?
I think they're going to be pretty neutral because it's the same government. Everyone had hoped that the other people would get in and they might force some of the issues. I mean, the government's promising to fast track permitting, but it's not really happening on the ground. And I think that is going to be an even bigger concern for exploration going forward than politics with America is we've raised the money to drill. Especially if you've raised it through flow through, my drill permit still hasn't come through. So I think that's the level where the government really needs to get its act into gear is sorting out the exploration and development permitting. They're saying they are, they're bandstanding they are, but we're not seeing the results yet. And of course, if Ontario goes the way of British Columbia when they take away free staking, that will be a concern. And again, we're fortunate that we've got active permits. We're not actively picking up more claims either at the moment. So at that stage, we're sitting pretty well, I feel.
I think, in one sense, Mark, companies like ourselves with multiple projects in good standing with good relationships with First Nations, if things do get a bit trickier, it sets us apart even more so from the rest as well. So for every negative on a larger scale, there's a positive if you're kind of running against it, really.
Yeah, no,
Yeah,
it sounds like though obviously from the outside looking in, it's been a traumatic period of time. You've continued to get on with the job in hand, and yeah, it's Ontario and gold, gold, gold. So let's see how you progress over the next few months. And yeah, we look forward to speaking to you again in the not too distant.
lovely.
That'll be great.
Thanks, guys. Really appreciate the time.
James Knowles and Mark Sale of First Class Metals, thanks very much for appearing on the podcast.
Let's move on to our second guest this week. We're joined by Kevin McNulty, senior geologist, and Cathal Jones from the board of Carelian Diamonds. Welcome back to the podcast, gents.
Thanks very much,
Thank you
Phil.
Very much.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's been a transformational week for the company and their flagship Lapjoki diamond project in Finland. First, the mining concession was formally registered in the land registry, and now the company has received the official mining concession certificate from Tuks, granting full mining rights and clearing the way for the next phase of development. Lapjoki is a standout project covering 71 hectares. It hosts over 2 million carats of diamonds, including highly sought after pink and coloured stones that can command prices up to 20 times that of standard gems. A 2017 preliminary economic assessment projected a 9-year mine life with a 2-year payback, an IRR of 55% and an NPV of $39 million based on colourless stones alone, highlighting the considerable upside still untapped. Today, we'll be exploring what these major regulatory approvals mean for the company's roadmap and the future of diamond mining in the EU. So, yeah, I mean, obviously, with the mining concession certificate now in hand, what specific steps are you prioritising as you move Lapjoki into its next phase of development?
Yeah, it's been an incredible journey going forward with Lapjoki. As you saw today, we released the news of the mining concession certificate issued by Tuks. The next steps are going towards bringing the project into a mine, a full mine production. But to do that, we need to go through a few steps, including the bulk sampling phase of the project. We've already got quite a bit of drilling undertaken there. There's over 5,000 metres of drilling, of which 1.77 tonnes of that have already been assayed for microdiamonds and show very good diamonds present, including those fantastic pinks that we've seen. And those, some of those were recovered in the mini bulk sample, previous bulk sampling that was done by previous operators. But not only the pinks, but we get quite a few yellows in there as well. So there is quite a significant amount of fancy diamonds in there that weren't, as you said, taken into account in the economics that were done, which had the IRR of 55% and an NPV discounted at 8% of 39.1 million. Yeah, and that's over just a project life scale of 9 years. It probably can be extended from there. As you know, we're looking in the area as well for additional diamond potential as well, close and adjacent to Lapjoki.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, as you just said there, Kevin, the 2017 PEA highlighted pretty strong economics, you know, even without factoring in this premium for the pink diamonds. How do you see that potential upside evolving now that you have the full mining rights?
I see it evolving. As I said, we need to evaluate how many pinks and what's the percentage of pinks present. We believe there could be up to 5% or maybe even more, but we actually need to firm those figures out. And the other stones that are present, get a valuation and build a parcel of stones so we can get a full valuation present on the stones that are present there.
Sure. I mean, it's quite a statement, isn't it? Obviously, you know, Lapjoki is positioned to become the EU's first commercial diamond mine. What does that mean, you know, strategically for Carelian? We've talked in the past about the Kumo project as well, and obviously the hunt for these elusive green diamonds. Just talk us through the differences between the sort of geology at Lapjoki and Kumo.
Well, in Kumo so far, most of the kimberlites that we've discovered are what's referred to as orangeite or group 2 kimberlites. So the old term used to be group 2 kimberlites. In Lapjoki, it is a true kimberlite. It's a group 1 kimberlite. So it's a tuffaceous kimberlite present there. So it's actually a full eruption rather than the diatreme facies. The presence there of the pinks, we don't see. We haven't seen any pinks in some of these other areas. You're quite close to the craton boundary down in Lapjoki, and we believe because of the pressures and tectonics that go underway close to those that plate boundary that probably produce the strain to produce these pinks. I think in the past I talked to you, the pinks are due to a slight strain on the diamonds produces these pink colorations present.
So Kevin, I'm going to ask you a question, a geological question. How do these diamonds become pink or yellow or green for that matter, and how much more in the marketplace is a value placed on these as opposed to the clear white diamonds?
The value certainly for the pinks can be up to 20 times higher than the normal price for diamonds, and particularly like, you know, some of these real fancy pinks. You get the cherry blossom ones that obviously have significance in Japan and things like that. But going back to how they're formed, the pinks are generally formed by a slight distortion of the diamonds when they're being formed, a distortion in the actual shape of them, which causes the pink coloration. The greens are due to a radiation effect, that the diamonds have been exposed to some type of radiation at depth.
Wow.
And the yellows are a nitrogen content. So
Okay.
they will have been formed when there was nitrogen or nitrogen component being brought into them. And that forms. So it's very specific circumstances that form these quite unique stones, as I say. So we're very lucky to have both yellows and pinks present in Latiyuki.
And at
You
20, no, I wanted that answer. At 5% being pinks, that and the 20 times the valuation or thereabouts, that actually doubles the amount of diamonds you actually have in value terms. And that's quite an uplift.
Absolutely. That's why we need to bring that into the economics and firm up the exact amount of percent of pinks and yellows and fancies that are present in Lakioki. And it's very crucial for the economics because at the moment we're just running on everything being a clear white diamond, which is not the case as we know.
Yeah, and Kakal, I have a question for you then. I've in my own brain have been looking at the valuation of must be worth at least 10 to 15 million euros just for the license itself, now that you have it, regardless of anything you do with it. And I know you're not planning to sell it, but would that be fair with a net present value of 39.1 million? You know, to actually sell the license on to someone else gives you a net asset value within Carillion Diamonds.
I suppose you're right. It does give us a firm value and a firm flag and stake in the ground. That the interesting, I suppose the interesting point, taking a slight step back, is that PEA that we did immediately on acquiring the asset as it was then. PEA is 8 or 9 years old, so it has taken us 8 or 9 years to get through the steps to get to this point, where the mining concession is now ours and registered. And you're right, that does have a value. It's we have the right to mine this kimberlite in this deposit now. No, obviously there are steps we need to go through, etc., but it's a critical stage along the way. I always liken exploration to property in many ways, because everybody understands property. It's like you buy a site with no planning. You get planning. That's another stage. You move it along with plans and a specific, moving it through the zoning and planning stages increases the value all the time. And this is one of the stages in exploration. And yeah, it does have a value. I'm not selling it at that level, but our certainly at that level is significantly north of where our market cap is at the moment, which just gives a sense of the overall potential of the company as a whole, never mind just the company if it was a single asset entity at Latiyuki.
Yeah, if you have the single asset at Latiyuki with a current market cap of 2.4 million pounds, and yes, it's gone up 150, 60% on the day that this was announced and the day we're recording this, which was Thursday. The reality is the 2.4 million pounds doesn't do it. I mean, if somebody wants to come in and buy Carillion Diamonds now, they're not going to be able to do it for 2.4 million pounds now that you have this asset.
No, and it's going to be a very interesting journey as we move this asset through the phases, etc. And we're looking forward to it. One of the things that you touched on actually a little earlier was what's unique about this being the first diamond mine in Europe. And I think one of the critical niches that a diamond European diamond mine will have in the market, because there is a market for natural diamonds. Obviously, there's a growing market for manufactured diamonds, but it's all about provenance. Your stones, your natural stones now need to come certified. We know where they're from. We know they're sustainably produced, etc. And we'll be all over that. We'll have color. We'll have European provenance. There'll be a premium in Europe for a European diamond and for a sustainably produced European diamond versus elsewhere. So there's really I believe there's a strong market
That's a very polite way of saying that nobody wants to buy Russian diamonds.
Well, I didn't say that, Phil.
Effectively, but yeah, no, I get the whole provenance thing, as you say. I mean, it's EU's first, really, isn't it? Potentially as a candidate.
Yeah, and just so everybody knows as well, Kevin, tell us what other assets are going, because I mean, couple of years ago now, we visited a very rainy Northern Ireland in the summer. You know, KDR has a huge asset there in Northern Ireland. So just tell us a little bit about that as well, because that's obviously part of the game.
Yeah, absolutely. We have, as you know, up in Fermanagh, we originally sort of looked in that area for diamonds as well, but we were fortunate we found something else totally different. As sometimes happens, as you know, the story of Voisey's Bay, where they found a massive nickel deposit. Similarly, we found indications up in this area for copper nickel PG mineralization. And we're starting to see some very good copper results in the area and some good nickel results through the soil data that we've seen and through indicator mineral work that we've done. And there's been several platinum nuggets recovered in and around some of these areas, including where we're taking up the new Antrim license area that we're looking to take out as well. So it's pretty exciting going forward.
So from the diamond point of view, moving backwards.
Yep.
The two diamond scenarios that we have now within Carillion, what stages are both of them at now that we have the license for Lockyer?
Well, Latioki, as you know, it's got a deposit there and it's now got its mining concession certified. So we are, you know, at a very, very significantly advanced stage there. We still need to do some bulk sample work on that. And we have around that, we have Latioki South, where we found this boulder. We've had some very good indications. So there is potential adjacent to Latioki for an expanded project. But I think Latioki not only gives us our first mine foothold, but it gives us the potential to test a lot of the other kimberlites in Finland as well. Once we have an operation up and running, you have the option of being able to process material from other areas as well as part of that operation. So it really does, it opens up the whole of Finland to us by giving us that cornerstone of operation present there.
And really the land in, or the mark in the land is basically between Russia and Finland, whether you have a Finnish diamond or whether you have a Russian diamond, because this area is very rich in diamonds, is this fair to say?
Absolutely, yeah. There's so many, like over the border, you have obviously the Grieve and Arkhangelansky and Lomonosov pipes. And then in Finland, most of the kimberlites in Finland are actually diamondiferous. Latioki is the most advanced project. It's the only project in Finland that has a full diamond resource and has got the mining concessions being done. But as I say, the marketing for that, it's sort of like Welsh gold. You know, Welsh gold demands a premium, where you're going to have Finnish diamonds that are going to demand a premium in a niche market.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I remember there was some mention of a couple of other projects. Was it Saitaperä and Rivara as well? And there was permitting granted a while back. Can you just give us an update on what your plans are for those, Kevin?
Saitaperä is one of the largest kimberlites in Finland. That runs at about 6.9 hectares in size. And it does have a significant amount of diamonds present in it as well. But we think it's a large stone size. So we need to have the equipment to bulk sample that. And that would be probably done in conjunction with Latioki's bulk sample. We would probably move on to look at the Saitaperä pipe after that. As you're aware, we have Rihavara, which is where we discovered a kimberlite there. And we are doing test work in relation to that to look for the diamonds present in that. And following that up with ground geophysics and airborne geophysics that we have done throughout that area. And then in Anomaly 5, we are doing a lot of work in there, as you know, with the recent pitting, drone geophysics that we've done. So we believe we have located, you know, through that geophysics, potentially the source of where that green diamond has come from. So we definitely want to test that going forward as well.
So Kevin, on Lakioki, you said, I don't know whether it was to the south or to the west or the east or whatever, or to the north, but you said you've discovered another boulder.
Yes, that's to the Lakioki south, we call it. And yes, there was a boulder discovered there. It's significant because it's not the same type as kimberlite as you find in Latioki. As I said, Latioki is a tuffaceous kimberlite. So where the boulder was a hyperbissal kimberlite. So it comes from a deeper level of a kimberlite body. So it can't have come from really Latioki itself. And also it's not in the right position to be carried as a boulder from Latioki. So yes, we are actively looking, and that boulder had really good indicator minerals present in it, potential G9 and G10 garnets present in it. So we are looking for the source of that boulder.
Yeah, and G9, G10 garnets mean that there should be the presence of diamonds.
Diamonds, they form at the same temperatures and pressures as where the diamonds form. That's why we look at those particular garnets.
Very good. Well, this has been obviously a great movement now for Brilliant. Hopefully people can start to see that the potential. I mean, even the potential in Northern Ireland is absolutely vast in terms of what you've got on the cards. But I think the diamonds alone obviously worth much more than the market cap at the minute. So, yeah, let's see where this goes from here.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting, Kevin, I think. And as I say, you know, Lathiochi is just one bow to a multiple bows, to multiple arrows that we have to shoot. So, and it's really advanced projects and quite exciting. And particularly with the coloured stones present there, yeah.
I think I'm looking forward to my gold cladder from Conroy Gold Discs of Gold with a nice green diamond in it, and I wonder what the premium will be for this.
Great,
big.
Big, big. Big. Yes, big. Says the chief financial officer.
Yeah. You can see him cringing at that one already, can't you? It's way above budget, but on that note, we'll say. Cathal Jones and Kevin McNulty of Carillion Diamond Resources, thanks very much for appearing on the podcast.
Thank you.
Guys.
Okay, let's have a look at some of the movers and shakers of the week. I mean, it's no surprise that the best mover, I suppose, was Carillion Diamond Resources, up some 120%. Obviously, we just covered the news and the reasons why they've moved so well. The second best mover was Haydale Capital, HAYD is the ticker, up 100% on the news of making strong progress with its Just Heat graphene-based low-power heating system, now UL certified for North America and CE mark for Europe, enabling wider commercial rollout. Over 40 pilot installations are secured with Welsh social housing providers and further talks ongoing with distribution agreements signed with Kidos, Protect and Jet in the Channel Islands, expecting to generate £6 million over 5 years. And then I guess the worst performer or the shaker of the week was Met One, down 60%. Ironically, this was one of the biggest rises of the year. I can't really see any major significant news other than maybe, I mean, there was a notice of exercise of 400,000 cash warrants and 12 million prepaid warrants at 2 pence per share, resulting in the issue of an extra 12.4 million shares. They would be admitted to trading on the 16th of June. But I think there was also news on one of the signing of one of their projects in the US. But I spoke to Charles on this briefly just to see anything. And he thinks that some of their kind of marketing funding may have dried up in terms of budget in the US. I mean, did you see that, the drop? It was, I think it breached 48 to 50p cap at the highest, and it sort of finished the week around about the 9 pence mark.
Yeah, I saw it happen. Yeah, I don't think there's any what's the right word? I don't think there's any surprise that those two things that you explained happened at the same time. Yeah. I mean, I think the stock has probably been then pre-sold, especially if you know, they've just been issued at 2p. And they're obviously still making money, whoever's received those shares. So, yeah, but I think it did go down even lower, didn't it? And then bounced a little bit back up, you know. So we will see. It's been an absolute roller coaster, hasn't it? Well, I mean, it looks like it's had an epic rise from 0.2p to 50p, but there was consolidation in there as well. So I think, you know, what we're looking at when it gets to 8p is maybe 0.8p now as opposed to 0.2p, which it was, I think. So it's maybe not as epic a rise as everybody thinks it is, though, you know, it still will have gone up, you know, 4 or 5 times and then come back 4 or 5 times, if you like.
Yeah.
So yeah, we're in a market now. I mean, let's spin the positive out of it. Is there's liquidity out there, isn't there? We've got movers galore during the week. We've still got the smart web company like going from strength to strength and raising again on Friday, 15 million more to buy more Bitcoin to keep moving ahead. You know, a market cap of 340 million or something at £2, I think it was, and now probably more because they've issued more equity. But whether you like it, love it, hate it, it doesn't really matter. The issue is that that's creating more and more liquidity within the market. So, yeah. And as we heard from the guys at Carillion, you know, that did at one point, you know, 160, 170% finished up maybe 100% on the week, or 100-something% on the week.
Yeah.
You know, we have liquidity. People are now starting to look at opportunities and say that's ridiculously cheap. And it is. If you look at Carillion now, even at 1.2, 1.3, 1.4, whatever it actually finished at, the reality is there's still only 2.1 million, 2.2 million value of a company that has an asset that for sure is probably worth £10 million plus and several other assets as well. So, you know, yeah. There is a lot of catching up to do. I had a conversation with Charles at one point this week as well. Just the catching up that is required can be 200, 300, 400%, and still you're not even probably at fair value. You know, we got the same thing going on with Byzant. You know, Byzant, the shares that they're holding now in Blackstone have gone up. They're worth £7 million. Got Hope and Gorup, which minimum's got to be worth $30 million with the license and 190,000 tons of contained copper and gold credits. And you've got a market cap of just over £4 million. Blackstone shares are worth over £7 million in effectively cash assets. This doesn't make any sense. You know, the stock should be 3 or 4 times higher than it is now. You can call that a ramp. You can call that a ramp, but it is reality.
If you look at the value of that stock, for sure, that even that value alone, it doesn't put any value into any of the assets, really. If you look at the investment in Blackstone,
well, it puts a negative value into it. Yeah. You know, even if the share price was the Blackstone one, which would be like 0.45 or something like that, as opposed to 0.03, at least that would be the cash value.
You'd
have to think that would make sense.
Yeah.
And that's like a 50% rise. So, you know, there are many, many, many anomalies. But yeah, go on.
Yeah. The other one that I want to talk about is Greatland, that they had a good week. They finished around 17.3 pence, which is about 18% on the week. So, you know, not too shabby performance. But obviously they announced the launch of a book build. Obviously, there's a non-preemptive placing of new ordinary shares to raise proceeds of up to about 50 million Aus dollars, which was their Australian primary offer. And then they also announced a UK retail offer to raise proceeds of up to about 8 million euros to provide retail investors in the UK with an opportunity to subscribe for new ordinary shares in the company at the final offer price, which is obviously going to be determined through the book build. So, good to see them. You know, obviously they want to add a little bit of bring in a few more retail. Obviously, presumably the caveat would be that you have to hold anyone had to hold Greatland shares to be involved in that, certainly from a UK perspective. Not sure on the Australian, but good to see them sort of bringing money, you know, generating more money for the listing, etc., in connection with the ASX listing.
Yeah I mean, when we spoke to Sean, he said this was what was going to be happening, didn't he? That they had to have a sort of 2% or something like that raised to have the liquidity on the Australian market as well. So, I see it flying into the mid-20s, to be honest. I don't see, from what I've read and the valuations that are already in the Australian market, and gold powering to an all-time high, could it be any better to hold a copper gold producing stock in Australia? You know what I mean? I'm not sure it could be any better. I think 25 to 30 p's possibly a given in the next few weeks, months, just because of buying that is required probably by the funds that are in Australia, and even the GDX Junior, the VanEck thing, for gold miners, they're going to have to take a bigger proportion just because of its market valuation has continued to rise. So there are factors there that will only see it rise. I think I can't see anything else, but you know, we've been wrong before, so let's see what happens.
Yeah, the Celadon had some news. Basically, a new committed credit facility. It entered into a new £500,000 1-year unsecured credit facility with a European-based high net worth individual lender and has received funds totaling £500,000 to date. So they were up about 25% on the week, trading around 12.5 pence.
Yeah, I spoke through messages with Jim during the week, and he was very happy that that money had had arrived. And the RNS also specifies that there is the bigger investor is also just going through some checks for things to happen. But I think it's it looks like it's odds on that other money will arrive, and then that'll put them in a very secure position. And yeah, we'll have Jim on as soon as that happens. I would hope.
Tiger Royalties as well. They announced a £250,000 investment in this Standard Strategies, which is a pioneering kind of Bitcoin treasury investment. So that one looked interesting. It all seems to be about very much about the whole, as you say, the smarter web company, the whole Bitcoin treasury thing. We saw actually at the end of the week, Bitcoin trading around $105,000, which has kind of maintained a steady upward trend. And again, that's probably, related to geopolitical. We obviously saw all sorts of gold surge into $3,440 per ounce, hitting record highs again due to these geopolitical tensions and increased safe haven demand. What do we make of the performance of those two?
Yeah, it hasn't really happened yet, has it? Yeah. For Tiger Royalties. It seems to be the overflow of what's happened with the smart web company hasn't really hit many other companies. Coin seems to have taken a bit of a bid, but there are many in there, aren't there? You've got Tiger Royalties, you've got Priority One, who have also said they're doing the same thing, though they haven't really announced what they're going to do yet. They just said they're going to do it. I don't know. There are a few, aren't there? There are a few on the what was that other one that you talked about? Psycho.
Yeah. There's Cap AI. There's quite a few doing it now. There's a whole list of them sort of circulating. But yeah, it is interesting to see. And as I say, with Bitcoin doing so well, it certainly seems to be the place to be.
Well, what people have been saying is this the one the UK look at Bitcoin for the general public, if you like, or the general investor? And secondly, is this the way that Bitcoin is going to go, that actually, because now it's $100,000 plus and potentially could be much more, you know, are they going to be held by institutions, companies, you know, wrappers, if you like, so people don't get burnt with Bitcoin themselves? And this is going to be the way to hold them. Now, I still think, you know, smarter web company, each Bitcoin's worth like $1.5 billion or $1.5 million or something. It still doesn't make a lot of sense. But if they have the ability to keep raising and buying other businesses that can actually produce some revenue so they can continue to buy Bitcoin, then the whole thing works. So I'm interested to see how this is going to move forward and whether it just becomes a Bitcoin play or that they will actually try and become a business that creates, you know, cash flow that can buy Bitcoin. If it does that, then it can sustain its valuation and keep going forward, actually, I think.
Yeah.
So it's a meme stock as well. You know, everybody's like, we're on it, we're on it, we're on it. So there you go. We'll see.
Yeah, definitely. One thing I want to just quickly touch on is lithium. I read a really interesting article about a looming crisis for EV manufacturers in Europe, the US and China due to a looming shortfall in domestically sourced lithium, which is obviously crucial for EV battery production. And there was some research from East China Normal University and the Lund University in Sweden, which highlighted that this shortage could delay global climate goals as battery demand outpaces the ability to extract and refine lithium locally. I mean, you know, we've seen surges in copper price, and obviously it's dropped back a little bit this week, but gold and silver have also done really, really well. But why hasn't lithium surged? You know, we saw things like oversupply concerns where production of lithium ramped up aggressively in 2022-23, particularly in the likes of Australia, China and Latin America, which led to a glut in supply and pushed the prices down from their 2022 highs. There was a lot of stockpiling going on as well, working through inventories, reducing near-term demand. And then obviously also the slower EV rollout has kind of, faced slower than expected sales in some markets due to very high interest rates, which put a strain on people buying them, and obviously consumer hesitancy and lagging infrastructure, certainly in the UK, where we kind of don't have the infrastructure for charging, which tempered lithium demands. But do we think lithium will rise? Because they are predicting that while the short-term pricing has been weak, the case for a kind of lithium recovery is strong, especially if these supply bottlenecks do materialize. What are your thoughts? What are your thoughts on lithium, Kev?
I think, and I'm quoting Rick Rule in this situation. I don't think the pain's got high enough yet. I think there's still an oversupply. Do we think we're going to continue to use the quantity of lithium that everybody anticipated, expected, when we thought EVs were going to be on every corner within like 2 minutes? Not sure. I think it will recover, but I'm not sure now's the time. It could be another year, it could be another 2 years, but I think it will recover. And when it does, it's probably going to explode.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think you're right. I think you're right. The pain, we're not in the pain barrier at the moment, are we? Or the threshold. And we've not hit that peak period. But no, it's just interesting. I've just seen, there's been a lot of stocks that have been were doing exceedingly well. Things like clean tech lithium was really, really there running well, wasn't it, in the UK. We saw a lot of explorers focus, lithium plays, even things like Kibi in with Guardian, that kind of obviously has been moved focus to, bigger projects, metals like tungsten, and obviously we've seen a little bit of the work done at the Golconda for the gold, but I think a lot of companies are putting these projects on the back burner until we see some kind of increase in the lithium price. But I mean, one interesting article, just going back to the, I think your point at the top of the show about autonomy and about Tesla using autonomous vehicles and the technology there. There was a Stagecoach, a company in the UK, and they began operating self-driving buses on a 14-mile route between Fife and Edinburgh via the Forth Road Bridge. And this was done in May 2023. But the vehicle still required two staff on board, a safety driver who could take control of the bus in the if there was a requirement for that, and a captain to sell tickets. The service ended in February because of a lack of passengers. I mean, what does that tell you about getting on an autonomous self-driving bus?
Yeah, people aren't there yet, are they? But they
Yeah.
will get there, I think.
Yeah.
It's just like is it any different than they used to have a person run before the car
Yeah.
when they were first invented? It's probably no different now. Ultimately, we will get used to it, and then we'll realize that the safety is actually probably higher than having a driver, and then we will accept it.
Okay, I mean, in terms of TV recommendations, all I'll say is The Gold Series 2, BBC 2, about the Brinks Matte heist, gold heist in the UK. Very interesting how they discarded and smelted the gold in the robbery. You've got to shoot, Kev, so I think we've talked long enough. We'll wrap up. We'll say thanks for listening, all. If you do like what you've heard, please do subscribe. Hit the bell icon for any further notifications of future episodes. And all the fathers and dads out there, have a great day. What's left of it, enjoy it. And yeah, have a great weekend, all. Thanks for listening.
Hopefully, I'll be back in Egypt by the time you hear this.
Yeah, good luck with that, Kev. Good luck getting out of there.
Yeah. Okay, guys.
Okay, cheers,
Thanks
all.
for listening. Bye bye.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.